Today we're going to open our Bibles to Exodus 33, where we'll start at verse number 7 in a moment. I want to remind you that we're looking at the fallout from the golden calf incident. Moses had gone up and spent 40 days with God, getting information about the tabernacle, getting information to fine-tune the rules of the community of dealing with God, dealing with each other, dealing with the world, how they were going to live when they went into the promised land. Unfortunately, as you know, at the end of that 40-day period, the people panicked, I suppose you could say it that way, and they decided that they needed to abandon Moses and move on to the promised land. And so the golden calf gets made. Moses comes down the mountain the day of the big golden calf dedication and the partying that's going on, and he shatters the first edition of the God-autographed Ten Commandments, and then proceeds to punish the people by turning the golden calf into gold dust and sprinkling on their water source. He gets some of the Levites to act as sergeants of arms to put a stop to the continuing partying that's going on, and about 3,000 people die. And then he turns around and intercedes with God. And God tells him that, no, I'm not going to write you out of the book just to save them. Basically, the ones that did the crime will do the time. And we know that there was some sort of plague that came upon the community, impacting on the ones that were the main offenders of this golden calf incident. And so now, in chapter number 33, God has told Moses, now I personally am not going the rest of the way to the promised land with you, because if I did, I'd wipe you all out. Now this seems to be a reference to God the Father, who is holy and separate from sinful humanity, and he does not intend to stop his Holy Spirit presence in the form of the glory cloud from going with them up to the promised land. In fact, he mentions it again, that the angel in whose presence the name is, he will go with you and he will guide you. So this is kind of some hard things for us to get our minds wrapped around, because it relates to the triunity of God, which is mysterious to us. It is beyond our comprehension. The last thing that we looked at last episode was that God told them to strip their ornaments off. And it seems to be a reference to a bunch of jewelry and bodily decorations, perhaps out of the wealth they'd collected when they left Egypt. They must have really gussied themselves up for part of the golden calf dedication party. And so God says, strip that stuff off. I want it off you. And so we're told in verse 6 that they stripped themselves of these ornaments from that moment at Mount Horeb onward. We will eventually get to a passage where God gives them a separate decoration to wear with their clothing or on their clothing that is not for anything other than to remind them that they are people of the covenant, that they've made an agreement to be holy as God is holy. And we'll talk about that tassel or that prominence that they'll be wearing on their clothing once we get past this next 40-day period that we're talking about. All right, before we go into the next 40-day period that Moses spends up on Mount Sinai with God, we have a little bit of information, logistical information that helps us to picture what's going on normally in the camp. So Exodus chapter 33, verse 7, now Moses used to take the tent and pitch it outside the camp, far off from the camp, and he called it the tent of meeting. And everyone who sought, he who is, would go out to that tent of meeting, which was outside the camp. This is not the tabernacle. The tabernacle will not be ready for use until the first month of the second year of the Exodus. And we're here only at the beginning of the fifth month of the first year of the Exodus. So it's more than a half a year out into the future for the official tabernacle tent. This seems to be a tent that Moses has used the entire time that they've been traveling from Egypt to Mount Sinai, and now while they were at Mount Sinai. It is, for all practical purposes, Moses' office, where he meets with God and meets with people. You might remember when his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, showed up, when they were just arrived at Mount Sinai. He got after Moses because Moses was spending every single day from sunrise to sunset hearing cases alone from all the people, listening to their gripes, their complaints, their accusations against each other, their lawsuits. And his father-in-law told him, you can't keep that up. You'll wear yourself out. You'll wear the people out. You need to get some help, some assistance. And now Moses has not yet done that. He won't do it until God tells him he has to do it at the beginning of the second year of the Exodus. But this seems to reference the place where he did all of that. It's outside the boundaries of the camp. So everybody has to line up and come out to have their conversation with Moses, and his conversation with God. Now, this is how each day apparently started. Verse 8, whenever Moses went out to the tent, all the people would rise up, and each would stand at his tent door and watch until Moses had gone into the tent. And when Moses entered the tent, the pillar of cloud would descend and stand at the entrance of the tent, and he who is would speak with Moses. And when all the people saw the pillar of the cloud standing at the entrance of the tent, all the people would rise up and worship each at his tent door. So apparently each, I'm going to call it business day, each office day, Moses would walk out there in the morning, enter the tent, God's holy presence would come down, block the entrance, and he and Moses would apparently have some sort of beginning of the day conversation. And then I suppose that it would rise up, this presence of God would rise up enough that the people would then know, okay, now we can go and present our cases and Moses will take them to God or he'll sort them out for us. But they would worship this beginning of the day that Moses was at this tent of meeting. Verse 11 ties Moses with something said about Abraham. Thus, he who is used to speak to Moses face to face, as a man speaks to his friend. So Abraham was called the friend of God because God spoke to him. We know of at least one incident where God spoke to him in human form face to face. So here is Moses in that same boat day by day, speaking with God. Now, all of this is going to be important for the next story. Now, when Moses turned again into the camp, his assistant Joshua, the son of Nun, a young man, would not depart from the tent. So we've talked about Joshua several times now. He is Moses' aide-de-camp. He is going to be Moses' successor as the leader of Israel. It says here he's a young man. He is actually about 42 or 43, somewhere in that neighborhood. We base that off of information we know later in the story, how old he'll be whenever Moses has passed from the scene. So Joshua seems to live at the tent of meeting all the time. And Moses goes back and forth from the camp, probably to his own personal residence, and also to do things in the camp itself. Now, with that background material, we go back to the conversation that is happening between Moses and God on the day after the golden calf incident, which would, now we're talking about it being the second day of the fifth Jewish month. It happens to be a Sabbath day. And this is what God tells Moses and what Moses speaks to God about. Verse 12, Moses said to He Who Is, "See, now you say to me, 'Bring up this people,' but you've not let me know whom you will send with me." So this is back to the conversation we were having at the beginning of the chapter, that Moses is upset that God is now saying, "I'm not personally going to go with you, because if I go with you, I'll end up striking these people down because they are stubborn. They are obstinate. They are rebellious in their hearts. And I'm going to try to spare them a little bit longer." But Moses is like, "But you have to go. We need you. And you're not telling me who's going to go in your place, other than just mention this messenger. Yet you have said, 'I know you by name, and you have also found favor in my sight.'" So Moses is like, "Now you've told me you know me personally, and that I found favor in your sight. So, verse 13, if I have found favor in your sight, please show me now your ways, that I may know you in order to find favor in your sight. Consider, too, that this nation is your people." So Moses continues to act as the intercessor. He is trying his best to do this job now, even though, you know, several months ago when this story first started, he didn't want the job. Now he seems to not only want the job, he wants to do it well, and he needs God to help him. The little note, or the little mention here at the end of verse 13, "Consider too that this nation is your people," that's probably in relationship to how God told him up on Mount Sinai, "Go down, your people are out of control." And so now here is Moses reminding God, "They're your people too." Verse number 14, "He said, 'My presence will go with you, and I will give you rest.'" So this is God saying, "Look, Moses, my presence is going to be with you." The word presence here is literally the word face. And that becomes important in the wording here in a bit. So God the Father apparently does not plan on going with them, but God the Spirit will be with them. And God the Spirit is God. I know that sounds very confusing, but it's related to the mystery of the triunity of God. So God's presence will take them to the promised land and will give them rest. Now Moses says back to him, "Well, if your presence will not go with me, don't bring us up from here. For how shall it be known that I have found favor in your sight, I and your people? Is it not in your going with us, so that we are distinct, I and your people, from every other people on the face of the earth?" Now, this is, some of it, very rough to understand why Moses is reacting the way he is. I think it is the idea that he does not understand that the Tower of Cloud by day and fire by night is God's Holy Spirit presence. That is the face of God in a real form, his presence. But when God says, I am not going with you, Moses, I think, might believe that the tower is not going to go with them any farther. And I think there might be a little bit of confusion in that. And so that's why he keeps appealing with this idea. If you're not going to go with us, I don't want to go. We need you. We're your people. How's anybody going to know that we are your people if you're not in our presence? And then comes this. He who is said to Moses, this very thing that you've spoken, I will do, for you have found favor in my sight, and I do know you by name. So God assures him, yes, the presence will be with you. You will not be alone on the rest of this trip. I'm not going to just turn you loose and let you go. And so Moses takes this moment to make a special request. Moses said, please, show me your glory. Now, what's he asking? He's already seen the glory of God, hasn't he? I mean, he's been up in Mount Sinai where the glory of God came down and surrounded him for 40 days. So what's he asking about? You can tell this from what God says in response. He is asking to see God as he really is. He wants to see God in his fullness, in his reality. Now we know in the New Testament it says, no one has ever seen God. Now that's in the Gospel of John. We know that people have seen visions of God, more than one person has seen a vision of God. They've even described it in great detail about how God was seated on his throne, high, lifted up, how glory came from him, light came from him, like a rainbow of color. Well, while that is a vision of God, it is not God in reality, not God the Father. And so John, in the gospel that I was quoting from, says, no one has ever seen God, but the only begotten God who is in the bosom, in the personal space, the chest area of the Father, he has demonstrated him to us. And so this was a New Testament reminder that Jesus is God incarnate, that Jesus came here to planet Earth wrapped in flesh to show us God's character face to face, personally. But still, no one has ever seen God in his fullness, in his reality, with two exceptions at the beginning of history. That would be Adam and Eve, apparently had some sort of experience of God when they were perfect and holy, and then they lost it. And then, once we are past the sinful world, and we're in the new heaven and the new earth wherein righteousness dwells, we will see God as he is. We have in the book of Revelation descriptions of that, of the glory of God being there at the core, at the center of New Jerusalem, and all of us able to see him as he is. But for the moment, we're still in this situation now, today, that Moses was in, and that is, no one had really seen God as he really is. So he asks, please, God, show me your glory. Show me what you really are like. So verse 19, he, God, said back, I will make all my goodness pass before you, and I will proclaim before you my name, He who is. And I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, and I will show mercy to whom I will show mercy. But, he said, you cannot see my face, for man shall not see me and live. John the Apostle, probably thinking about this passage when he penned those words in the Gospel of John introduction. God explains to Moses, I appreciate your desire to see me as I really am, but it's not going to happen because no human being that has not been perfected out of their sin can see my face, my presence, my realness, and survive that because it involves judgment. The very thing that God expressed earlier, if I go with Israel on this journey, I'm going to end up executing them because of their sin. So I can't. I'm not going to do it. My Holy Spirit messenger will go, but not me. And so God tells Moses, I am going to give you a special experience, but we're going to limit your exposure to my glory. He who is said, verse 21, behold, there is a place by me where you shall stand on the rock. This is up on Mount Sinai. And while my glory passes by, I will put you in a cleft of the rock, so in some sort of alcove, and I will cover you with my hand until I've passed by. And then I will take away my hand, and you shall see my back, but my face you shall not be seen. And this seems to be a way of describing an afterglow. That God will put him in this cleft, maybe have him put his face, you know, into the interior of this cleft, and then he's going to cover him so that he can't look around, and then he'll come by, he will introduce himself with special words, and the glory of God is going to be all around him, Moses' back. And then God will finish passing by, finish his introduction, and Moses can turn around, and it'll just be the afterglow. It'll be more than what he's already experienced, but a lot less than what God really is like. And this is the reason why Moses will glow when he comes back down from Mount Sinai this time around. He did not glow after the first 40 days, even though he'd been in the glory cloud of God for 40 days. This next time he comes down, he will glow because something bigger happened, which God has just told him about in preparation for that event. Chapter 34. He who is said to Moses, cut for yourself two tablets of stone like the first, and I will write on the tablets the words that were on the first tablets which you broke. Now this is the reason I'm stressing it with my voice here is because there's wording that comes up later in the story that confuses people. And it's mostly the wording in English, I think, that causes the problem. And they want to argue that Moses wrote the second edition of the Ten Commandments, not God. But that is not the case based on this verse right here. God specifically said, you cut the tablets out, bring them to me, and I will do a second autographed edition because you broke the first ones. Now, he doesn't get after Moses about that. He just states that that's what happened to them. Now, Moses is then told, be ready by the morning, and then come up in the morning to Mount Sinai. Present yourself there to me on the top of the mountain. No one shall come up with you, and let no one be seen throughout all the mountain. Let no flocks or herds graze opposite that mountain. And so we get similar instructions to the first 40-day period. No one gets to join Moses. Everybody needs to stay behind the barriers. And Moses was obedient. Verse 4, Moses cut two tablets of stone like the first. Now, are they made of slate? That's definitely available in the area where I think the authentic Mount Sinai is. Were they a hard limestone or hard sandstone? Maybe, because that is definitely a predominant stone source in that region. But they are probably the size of notebook paper, and God is going to write with his own finger on both sides the significant portion of Exodus 20 that we refer to as the Ten Commandments. So he who is descended in the cloud and stood with him there and proclaimed the name of he who is. So Moses has now gone back up into Mount Sinai. He's going to be there through the rest of summer, the majority of summer, for 40 days. And God apparently starts out with what he promised at the very end of the instructions, and that is introducing himself to Moses and allowing his glory to permeate Moses' body in this introductory ceremony. And this is the reason why Moses glows. But the wording of this introduction becomes very important to the Israeli people. And it gets repeated over and over again as a representation of the character of God, that he is both loving and he is also just. And I want to focus on that next time we're in the Word.